Hello and welcome to the Limitless, the podcast between. This week I'm talking to Tim Kay about the book Wandering God, A Study in Nomadic Spirituality by Morris Berman from State University of New York Press, 2000. I thought you had read Wandering God and that was why you were recommending it, but it turns out that you'd just been getting around to it all this time.
Well, I had skimmed through it and I didn't really read in depth at the time, but this past week I had some time to get through most of it. We're probably not going to be able to cover all of it, but I think the first couple of chapters are the most important. I assume that you've read through everything.
Yeah, I read the whole thing. Well, I set the footnotes and there's a lot of the end notes, there's actually a lot of text in the end notes, but I only read the end notes that were particularly pertinent or of interest to me. But yeah, sure, we can't be comprehensive. I'm glad that you motivated me to read it, because it's been on on our bookshelf for going on 10 years. So that was how it happened, and I think it's one of the best books I've read, actually. And as I've said in the emails, that it does seem very complementary with The Prisoner of Infinity.
Well, certainly the main thesis that he has in the book is something went wrong millennia ago with the human race. And as I was reading it, skimming through it the first time and then reading it again, I had to think that the thesis itself probably isn't new, because of all the sources that he cites. He's giving another shape to the thesis, but I've seen this elsewhere before, just here and there, about, okay, so we can certainly say that early 20th century human culture is definitely not like it was in the 20th century and the 19th century and going further back. Things have changed, but there seems to be some common elements that are still here, and in fact even amplified, especially about COVID and the fear. Okay, so fear in the human race has been there since the beginning, but why has fear taken center stage? Or actually, also, why did it take center stage, maybe to a more muted level way back in the day? Why is it that fear was always there? And what struck me about the base thesis is that, okay, so instead of, he mentions it in the introduction about vertical versus horizontal. So we definitely lived in a vertical culture, starting from the low to the high. And that's because of sedentaryness, starting with agriculture, not to industrial scales, but way back when human beings who were hunter-gatherers and more horizontal nomads on them.
Do you want to define, for the new listeners, the listeners who are new to the book, the verticality and horizontality?
Sure. So the subtitle of the book is A Study in Nomadic Spirituality. And in the introduction, Berman cites what he calls the biological baseline, which is, so most everybody alive today is familiar with agriculture. Now we have industrial agriculture, but people in the past would have known somebody who had a farm. Okay, so being in one place, not moving a whole lot, and then tending to one's immediate tribe, and then growing one's food in one place, that's been the case for many millennia, but it was not always so. And then hunter-gatherers were those who did not invest in agriculture and instead were on the move in small bands, chasing whatever animals there were, or moving whenever something happened with some of the plants that they had. And they definitely moved around a lot. So because they moved around a lot, they did not have a vertical conception where if somebody isn't stuck in one place, sedentary, then they tend to look up. We're talking about religious themes here. They're looking up and finding whatever gods or spirits or whatever it is up instead of out, where the hunter-gatherers, because they're moving, are more in tune with moving forward, but maybe not so concerned about the future, because there's more of a diffuse sense as they're moving through the world instead of stuck in one place. And then this is the bounds of what they're experiencing, And so if there's anything beyond that, it might be beyond the immediate sense, the immediate parameters of what their experience is. But then they're also looking upwards. And so with
Yes, so I think you made an important correlation there that makes it easier for me anyway to understand between this verticality, this idea of that brings introduces hierarchy into community life, and that corresponds with religious, both religious and political hierarchies, and obviously religious belief in higher authorities, the correlation between that and looking towards the future as opposed to being fully in the present. And I would also say there seems to be a correlation between that and being more or less embodied, as compared to being in a mind or a conceptual space. So with these hunter-gatherers, they were, I mean, I have a very visual sense of this, of them existing in a horizontal plane, which is literally in terms of they're moving through the earth environment looking for things, hunting and gathering. So they're also more embodied because they're more aware of being physically involved and engaged with their environment, as compared to the sedentary culture, which then, which is all about, well, not all about, but it centers around being able to store stuff with an eye to a future. So even that social arrangement is about is future oriented. So then that introduces maybe awareness of death. I mean, I am totally improvising now, but there could be a correlation there that the more future-oriented a community becomes, the more conscious it becomes of its death in a conceptual sense, and then the religious hierarchical beliefs enter into there.
Right, and then Berman also mentions about meaning. So, in his thesis, the hunter-gatherers were far less concerned with meaning than were agricultural societies.
Yeah.
They didn't worry. They certainly didn't. Now, one can't say whether they ever had a conception of what meaning was, or if they ever thought about it. I mean, we are talking about primitive humans thousands and thousands of years ago. But his thesis, again, his speculation is that they probably did not obsess over meaning as to modern day humans, particularly over the past couple hundred years in agriculture and sedentary societies.
So something just popped in my mind. I know we're coming off the rails here in terms of a linear thing, but fuck it. I mean, that's actually part of what Berman is hypothesizing about that period in human history, that it wasn't that linear. So what came to my mind was something Dave O'Shaughnessy talked about, has talked about, which is this guy in Finland that I've done lots of work and stuff with. And he's talked about, he does physical energy work, which is a little similar to martial arts, but it's his own system since he got enlightened. He says he had some experience of entering into a different state of being. Anyway, and he said that in order to understand certain things, we have to first have a physical, the equivalent physical experience of what's being talked about. So, for example, in terms of dealing with people's negative energies, say that's a conceptual thing, and how to, if there are certain sort of psychological methods for absorbing or processing or rejecting those energies, he has physical moves that actually correspond with the kind of maneuvers that need to happen internally and energetically, so that our body is learning something. It's not as though it's an exact equivalent, but it's a parallel thing. There's a mental knowledge or a conceptual knowledge that is unrooted without a physical experience of the equivalent or parallel realities. Anyway, that's hopefully that was more or less clear, but it seems to correspond with maybe what we're touching on there in terms of this hunter-gatherer society, that they had an entirely different concept or relationship with meaning that was much more relating to their they're being constantly on the move, constantly in motion.
Right, when you're talking about it, the bodily basis, definitely something that came to mind is although for traveling, for example, it's somebody had never been to London or Paris before. You can read books and you can go online and read lots of different things, watch videos about what the streets look like, somebody that's moving through there, some of the main tourist attractions and things like that. And certainly lots of people would say that, well, you don't get the true, quote, true experience unless you're actually there. But then I would add to that is for those of us that are adults, certainly we learned early on about movement when we learned to walk and touching and more of the physicality and certainly the embodiment, where although you've never been to London and Paris and you don't have the quote true experience of what that city is or any city is, you definitely can put yourself in the position of understanding what it is, because you've already learned, although you've forgotten since then, of learning how to move, learning how to walk, and it's just something that you're not even aware of, but it's certainly bodily based.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I feel as though I slightly hacked into where you're going, because you were doing a pretty good summation. Did you still had places to go with that?
Sure, I wanted to cover some of his other points. He really lays out it well in the introduction. So, with the hunter-gatherers, he talks about the biological baseline, and there are three types of this. One, he says, is the existential awareness, which is the perception of having a self separate from the environment and from others that commonly surfaces in the third year of life. And then he deploys object relations, school, and psychology here. That when somebody becomes aware at 3 years old, it's an effect of alienation. That in history, when this happened, and again, he's speculating here, is that although, you know, hunter-gatherers, they had a different conception of the world, they still probably became self-aware as individuals when they were 3 years old. So then they felt a sense of alienation, and it was painful. And then ever since then, the human race is trying to grapple with it in three basic ways. So then there's the paradox, he calls, which is the experience of space. This is the diffuse or peripheral awareness, where you're moving into the world and you're not so conscious of things above you, around you, you're just moving through it. Hmm. I guess probably an analogy would be as like you're swimming. So if you're swimming ahead, you're in the water and you're moving forward, but you're not so conscious about your surroundings as much. You're just moving in that direction, and there's more of the diffuse awareness that's there. Mm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, although I was wondering if you were going to make a distinction there between just swimming and swimming towards a target, because I mean this whole area of what you're calling diffuse awareness and is interesting to me, because I'd written and thought about this some years back, this focused versus unfocused awareness. I even had a dream about it in which I gave them archetypal names, or I received archetypal names. It was the fool and the cowboy. So the unfocused awareness, which we could say is more feminine if we want to go there, is the fool, which is this archetype of this being that just wanders through the world, kind of equally immersed in everything and just fascinated by everything, like a little child. And then the cowboy is the focused awareness, which is the target, so the hunter or the shooter or that's more masculine, you know. So with your swimming analogy, the image I was getting was somebody who's swimming to a destination and therefore is so focused on the destination that they're not aware of even the water necessarily, versus somebody who's merely swimming in the water and just having an experience of the water.
Right, or you can even say driving in a car or riding on a bike. You have a destination in mind, you're not so aware of everything that you're going toward, like driving on the interstate. Okay, don't really care too much about what's around you unless there's something that really captures your attention, and then maybe you deviate from your original path to go in that direction, versus somebody who's just riding around or walking in the woods with no particular destination in mind.
Yeah,
definitely more the diffuse awareness.
Yeah, and so with the hunter-gatherer, we could see how it's both. Like they are looking for stuff, but at the same time they don't know where it is necessarily, so they have to just be exploring and tuned into their environment until they actually start to see signs, and then they would become more focused. Or indeed with hunting an animal as well, it'd be the same.
Right.
Anyway, so I interrupted you again, but carry on.
Sure. So back to his thesis about alienation. The first mode we just covered is the paradox, or the experience of space, the diffuse or peripheral awareness. This is how the humans dealt with the alienation sense. The second he calls the sacred authority complex, or the SAC. And I'll just read what he says here. And he says, despite what seems to be antecedents of it in Paleolithic times, I believe that its real flowering certainly in institutionalization coincides with agricultural sedentary civilization. Trust in the world is now much less, and fear of death has assumed a prominent place. The human being has not so much a world as a world view, and the perception tends to be vertical in nature. In other words, whereas with paradoxes, the sacred, such as it is, simply is the world. In the case of the SAC, sacrality has been projected upward into the realm of the gods. Hence, we get the great theocracies of the Near East, whose religious and political structures were embodied in pyramids and ziggurats reaching up to the sky. With a divine or a semi-divine figure at the top.
Okay.
So then he continues. Sometime around 2000 BC or after, the verticality of the SAC became even sharper. This was the emergence of what I have referred to elsewhere as the ascent experience, although traces of it may have existed in the Paleolithic. By ascent experience, I mean the phenomenon of unitive trance or ecstasy, which is the most dramatic way of generating temporary psychological security. Okay. Do you have anything to say about ascent experiences and unitive trances, ecstasy?
Well, lots, actually. I don't know if I should, because I'll try and be brief then. So the first thing is, the alienation, and this is definitely an area of over. Well, both are an area of overlap with prison and infinity. The alienation experience and what comes out of it, or what it leads to, and the ascended trance states. They're both central to prison and infinity. And the first one seems to me, and Berman does get into this, to center around the bonding with the mother and the separation from the mother, and whether it happens and how it happens, because the development of a sense of separate selfness, obviously, there's nothing like that in the womb, because the being is inseparable from the mother's body. But even as we emerge from the mother's body, we don't have a sense of existing as a separate self. So if there's this in between period where separating from the mother is very frightening, but so also is being immersed in her psyche, like hence comes this devouring mother complex. And so we're kind of caught between alienation and annihilation, as in, if we don't carry on separating and experience the terrifying alienation of being alone, it's even worse. We have to re-immerse in the mother's psyche and start to lose whatever sense of selfness we had, and so then it feels like death or annihilation. So that's definitely been central to all of my books in recent years. The second thing is what you asked about was these ascended states, and I'm not sure if I have so much to say there, except maybe because I've said too much, except that, oh well, that sounds like dissociation. Because especially the way you phrased it at the end, which I've now gone and forgotten. Do you remember what you said, the last thing you said?
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and read that again. Also, something in the next paragraph. So he says, by ascent experience, I mean the phenomenon of unitive trance or ecstasy, which is the most dramatic way of generating temporary psychological security.
Right.
And then further down, he says, in contrast to paradox or the diffuse alertness of the first coping strategy, consciousness, ascent experience is vertical and intense. It provides, quote, certainty, both in terms of its overwhelming numinous quality and in terms of the spiritual political hierarchy it inevitably generates.
Right. So, yeah, I feel like I probably can't say much more than that, because it's such a big, it's so huge, and it's so central to Prison Infinity and indeed all of my interests lately, that I just wouldn't be able to sum it up. It's kind of right there. I mean, this temporary security is exactly what dissociation provides when the experience of the present is overwhelming. And so again, you could see how that maps perfectly onto, as Berman does, onto the sacred authority complex, some sort of transcendental state or being or place to take refuge in, now that the mother's, you know, not safe, And the other thing is looking to the future. We do that all the time, don't we? When the present's unbearable, we just imagine this future state and fantasize ourselves into it. So it's very dissociative.
Yeah, one wonders if because of how we are, and also incorporating what Berman speculates here, is if we can't. I mean, the last time we spoke, I started off with language, and we know that there are languages out there that don't focus so much on the future versus something like English or Western European languages. But I have to wonder if there's something that's already hardwired into us about looking or obsessing over maybe not obsessing over the future, but certainly being preoccupied with it because of what we just covered here about you're looking for a temporary escape and a sense of certainty, whatever certainty happens to be, but it's not permanent. But maybe possibly your language pushes you in that direction because again, it's something that you grow up speaking a certain language and whatever its grammar is, that's already fixated in with you. Does that make sense?
It probably does. I went slightly off there, or maybe it was related. You can tell me into. There does seem to be a. I'm not sure. I don't know the biology much, but the prefrontal cortex. I have heard. I've read is about this projecting into the future. Now, is that also where language is centered, or not?
I think so. I don't. I'm sketchy on the details, but there are certain parts of the brain that are the language organ. I think it's a prefrontal cortex. Yeah, I would say that.
Okay, well, anyway, even if it isn't, what was occurring to me, whether it was directly relating to your question or not, was that if there's a relationship between imagining future scenarios, which is a survival mechanism, right, before any kind of obsession or dissociation, the need to imagine the future, from what I can deduce and what I've read by biologists, is it was a necessary skill that we developed, as in, if I go that way, will I get eaten by a predator? It's not just about sensory data, it's also a kind of speculation that becomes necessary. And if language is somehow part of that development of being able to project into the future, which I think it was, because I think both relate to the constructed identity self, then at what point did we start to use language to name things that weren't part of our actual environment, our sensory environment, i.e., God and heaven,
Or even the self.
or even the self, yeah.
Because there are some languages that don't have the subject pronoun, or it's not so important.
Yeah.
Where,
Right.
certainly in English and the European languages, there's the subject pronouns, I, you, me, the direct object pronoun. And but then that what's coupled with that is a sense of identity permanence. I am the same person that I was yesterday. I will be the same person, I believe, 5 minutes from now, 10 minutes from now. I will be the same person when I wake up tomorrow morning. I might be in a slightly different state, like maybe I wake up with a headache or I'm not feeling well, or I have boundless energy and I just run out the door to get a start on my day, whatever it is. But I'm still that same person, more or less, over time, type of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
it relates to, because it weirdly, I mean, those sentences you used, they're almost contradictory. And certainly, when a person says, "I was Napoleon in a past life," when they've gone way into the conceptual, it's meaningless. It's actually, semantically meaningless statement, because what, who's the I referring to? But even the sentences you used, they had that feeling to them when I was kind of breaking them down. Well, I will be the same person tomorrow. Well, that kind of suggests that you won't be somehow, even the structure of the sentence. So then it occurred to me, well, I mean, if language was primarily about naming objects, which is in the Book of Genesis, isn't it? Naming animals. Then once we named the self I, we started to think of it as an object, maybe. With permanence, some kind of permanence.
Some kind of permanence. Unless you're, for example, Immanuel Kant, where in the criticism of Descartes, who took the cogito as the thinking thing as a substance, Kant said that the I is just the transcendental unity of our perception. It's not a thing, it's just a, you could even say, a linguistic or conceptual knot that ties all the disparate senses together. I'm showing my philosophy background here.
Yeah, well, sure. I would say that comes kind of splitting hairs, and probably doesn't matter how much we define our terms if they've already defined us. See what I mean?
So we'll put a pin in that, and he continues on. So with the third way, he cites to, that humans dealt with this sense of alienation was, he calls it dullardism, which is lowering consciousness, in other words, spacing out. Trance practice still exists in these societies, but only as a type of, quote, heresy among marginal or fringe groups. This is why drugs such as Valium and Prozac are legal in the United States and Europe, and not why peyote, mescaline, and magic mushrooms, psilocybin, are not. With dullardism, the goal is simply to go unconscious by means of tranquilizers, alcohol, TV, spectator sports, organized religion, compulsive busyness, and workaholism, and so on, even though many of these do provide a short-term high.
Are you still in the intro, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is on page 5.
Okay. All right. Was that a pause to find the next quote or just to see what I was going to say?
No, to see what you were going to say.
Yeah.
You, I'm sure you would agree with that, is that this seems to be more, and he, this book is from 2000, I believe. He was starting to write it in sometime in the late 90s, so this is now 20 years later.
Yeah.
And you could certainly add surfing the net to that. And I'd say all of these things have been amplified.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't have much to add to it, although I could, could be pedantic about the thing about mushrooms and stuff, because I think that's become part of the narcotization of the people at this point as well. But beside that, I'd say just carry on. And by the way, I've been flicking through my book as well to see how much I've marked, and I would probably agree that most of the stuff I've marked is in the first three chapters. Certainly, there's quite a few things I got marked there. You said two, in fact, didn't you? So yeah, the first two. So I'd be interested to see, if we've marked different passages or if there's some overlap there. But anyway, carry on.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and skip to page 11, the next section, the coming of the SAC, which again is the sacred authority complex.
Yeah.
So he starts in the first paragraph. The SAC and later unitive trance are quite different from this. He was referring earlier to paradox, the diffuse awareness. So he says, what agricultural civilization managed to do was to disenchant the world in a peripheral sense and then reenchant it in a focused or centralized sense. Vertical energy finally overwhelmed and replaced horizontal energy. And as this is mirrored, as already noted, in the architecture of the great theocracies, such as Egyptian pyramids or Aztec temples, this energy is also the basis of religions and priesthoods.
Okay.
So Disenchant, I've seen, it was one of his earlier works from 1981, the Reenchantment of the World.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now I've also seen this elsewhere, particularly coupled with postmodernism of a slightly different take is if modernity was one of the main goals of modernity was to disenchant the world, to categorize it, rationalize it. Postmodernism is now re-enchanting it, whether it likes it or not. So it's a side note there. Okay, so on page 12, he continues, in any case, we see that the structure of religion in civilization, particularly Western civilization, whether we are talking about heresy or orthodoxy, is a vertical one, with the mundane world regarded as being down here below and heaven up above. Okay, so he picks 2000 BC as the start of that. You know, I don't have to continue to go through this. If there's anything that popped out for you that you wanted to focus on.
Well, at whichever point, I mean, certainly I think it's good to actually cite the work and respond to that, which is something, as you said, I could imagine doing even alone, as I've done with previous books, but it's more fun with two. The main thing that I was inviting you to there was just to sum up the verticality versus horizontality, so people would have a sense of that.
Sure.
So you've done that.
Well, let me go ahead and read the last paragraph of that section.
Okay.
Okay. So he says, vertical experience, whether of the SAC or the ecstatic variety, has an unavoidable political counterpart. Julian James, regarded bicamerality as a quest for certainty, in particular for authority or authorization. The psychic, quote, certainty of this experience was paralleled by the desire of agricultural civilization to possess certainty on other levels as well. A huge distortion ensued. With the rise of sedentary civilization, the human race went from paradox, the diffuse, a kind of kaleidoscopic consciousness, to fixed systems of religious, quote, truth. This development, I believe, has had enormous consequences in terms of our political adherence to ideologies of various kinds. The net effect has not been salutary. During the last four millennia, in particular, civilization has been preoccupied with transcendence, and this has led to a kind of absolutism in the way we live and think. Quote, cultural hypnosis means not only that we take whatever paradigm we live in as real, but that we can only conceive of escaping that paradigm by installing another paradigm in its place. Quote, worship, even of a secular variety, continues to be the norm.
Yeah. Okay, so nothing's coming up yet. Although this thing around the paradigm, I mean, it's very central to his thesis, this paradigm, what's he call it, paradigm addiction?
So he says, cultural hypnosis means not only that we take whatever paradigm we live in as real, but that we can only conceive of escaping that paradigm by installing another paradigm in its place. I think of Thomas Kuhn here in the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he definitely coined the term the paradigm shift.
Did he?
Yeah. So is, you know, the Newtonian world, and then Einstein comes along with relativity, and that shifts into a new paradigm type of thing. But what I'd say what he underscores here is that you're taking the paradigm as real. Yeah. And then earlier in the paragraph, he talks about the political adherence to ideologies of various kinds. So the fixation on that, taking it as real.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I kind of entered into that conundrum around paradigms when I was writing Prisoner Infinity, which is because of Changing Images of Man, which was this document, as you know now, that was part of the Stanford Research Institute, was, you know, how to regenerate the culture and transform it in ways that will allow same old to carry on, you know, into a bright new future. And it was all about bringing about a paradigm shift. And
when did that report come out?
1974.
Okay, that probably it wouldn't surprise me if they were informed by Kuhn, because Kuhn's book came out in the late 50s.
Right.
So about 20 or so years where that was, you know, I'm not intimately familiar with the literature back then, but I'm sure that was definitely a term bandied about at that time.
Yeah, and what I realized while contemplating that whole thing of paradigm shifts, and even warring paradigms, which is part of a shift, I think, usually one way or another. And of course, we're in that. We could say we're in the kind of more obvious worldview warfare currently, ideologically speaking. at least, is that the whole notion of paradigms itself belongs to a paradigm. There's a paradigm about paradigms, and yet they're being assumed to be some kind of unchanging empirical fixed fact of existence, i.e., that there the must always be a paradigm.
Right.
Right?
I also think about when we talked last, I mentioned Richard Rorty about the contingency of language,
Yeah.
where I don't think he would have had a problem with paradigms if, but again, his ideal ironist, as he described it, is someone who is aware that they're operating within paradigm through language
Yeah.
primarily, but who's also aware that this is contingent. You know, it never it's it is what it is now. It was not so way back when, and probably will not be so in the future, but you're taking it as so, and then you're not putting so much stock into it because you know that it's contingent.
Well, I would say, I mean, but this veers into postmodernism at that point, doesn't it? Because then you have a paradigm about temporary paradigms or non-fixed paradigms and so on. And I would say that, and postmodernism does seem to have its good points as well as its bad, and that the awareness that we construct, well, I guess we have to eventually get to the constructed identity, which is again this idea that the terms that we're trying to define have already defined us. So, but before, or at least on the way to that, that we who we think we are itself is a construction. The awareness that we do construct, what would you call it? Obviously, we don't construct reality, but we construct a filter, let's say, a perceptual filter through which we then have to experience reality. As in, we've got these names and these language and these beliefs that we then fit our perceptual experience into. It's like confirmation bias on a collective level, isn't it? So I used to write about this even in the early days of my the writing I would prefer to disown now if I could, that the way that we perceive existence is really determined by what we believe. That believing is seeing. So that I would say that it's really essential to be aware of that, but not to the extent that the postmodernists and I think these paradigm heads take it too, and the psychedelic movement as well as part of this, and what the bleep do I know, which is we create our own reality and therefore all there are paradigms. I think that's a lot of crap, because I think that what the body's perceiving potentially is an objective reality that I can't say it doesn't need filtering and it doesn't need interpreting, because it probably does, but there's still something there that exists that isn't determined by the filters that we put between it and our perception. And this is in Berman, but I read it somewhere else recently, and maybe it'll come to me who said it, but it was that we choose our worldview over the world. We're more afraid of losing our worldviews than we are of losing the world or our connection to the world. So that's the paradigm, isn't it? So that and this seems to relate to the horizontal experience, which is being in the world, like let's say, just for sake of argument, being fully in the world, therefore having a direct experience of being in the world and of being connected to the world, not necessarily being defined by it, but of being part of it anyway, let's say, being part of it, a living organism within the natural environment, versus having a relationship with an interpretation, with a worldview, and then actually, and this I would say this is the that what did you what did he call it? The temporary security of an ascended state, which I say, well, that's dissociation. I'd say that that's the world that we've ended up creating, is a counterfeit of the true world, which is really the externalization, the materialization of this imaginary simulation that we created through dissociation, which is the worldview. That's essentially, you know, our view of the world, which, I mean, maybe it begins initially, innocently enough, just as a fantasy realm where we just want to think about the things we like, but it ends up as an imposition whereby we have specific beliefs about the way the world is and the way it should be, which is easy to see how that becomes an ideology, you know, like a quasi-moral framework by which to judge the world and to be in the world and to reshape the world.
Well, I wanted to shift gears a minute and go to psychedelics, since you've taken a lot of psychedelics and this with the Ascend experience. So, given what you know and what you've learned, and in the context of what we're discussing with Berman, I'm curious that somebody who is going to, you know, the prime candidate would be ayahuasca, which I kind of roll my eyes over the past couple of years. You've seen this, where people are talking about ayahuasca is so transformative. You know, the Silicon Valley people are into this marketing and so on. Where to me, it never was the fact I'm not ingesting anything in my body that I know nothing about at all. But that's just me. I'm sure there are a lot, and there are lots of others that are like that. But somebody who takes the psychedelics to try to escape from, quote, the prison of what this is, and they ascend to another reality, we'll say. But then they come back down to that. What really would you say, trying to get into their minds, are they trying to do? Are they trying to attain some kind of certainty, or are they really trying to escape more by doing that?
Well, they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, I would say that's part of Berman's hypothesis, I think, is or thesis, is that the quest for certainty and the belief that we found it is dissociative. It does relate to it obliges or it depends upon disengaging from lived reality, because nothing is certain in lived reality. It's always changing. And I've experienced this viscerally, Dave O'Shaughnessy, again, just to, you know, bring it to cut, you know, solid examples. Because although he claims to be enlightened, which you'd say that's a fixed state, that's a final attainment, and so on, and you'd think, like, that was what I experienced with John DeRuyter, who pretended to that kind of thing, or he made similar claims, was this real certainty. Whereas with Dave O'Shaughnessy, what I've experienced is total uncertainty about so much. Maybe I'd say there's one thing he seems to be certain about. Which he's gone and named it, and I don't blame him for that, even though I don't feel I can adopt his name for it, but he's named it the Enlightenment Transmission, placekeeper for God, whatever. All these words are placekeepers. So he does seem to have an absolute certainty about that, but nothing else. I have hardly seen him be certain about anything else. He seems to be one of the most uncertain people in the world. But the way he acts, there's a real energy behind it, and like he talks about a baby. I mean, when a baby grabs your hand, it does it with its whole body. It has a baby has this embodied certainty of being here, but a baby knows nothing. And then younger children, they're always asking questions because they don't understand anything. So in a weird way, that's kind of how I experienced Dave O'Shaughnessy, and also my own experiences has been. The more rooted I've become in physical existence, the more embodied, the less certain I need to be, number one, and maybe that I'm able to be, although it's hard to say. If I don't need to be certain, then I don't necessarily try too hard. But I think it does go hand in hand with acknowledging that I can't be as certain as I thought about things and then maybe anything. I was going to say something else there about certainty, but I've kind of lost it. There's a, certainly a freedom in being uncertain, and that by the same token, there's an imprisonment in being certain. So I'd say the desire to escape is to escape this feeling of uncertainty, which isn't freeing. That somehow they feel imprisoned by it, which is the mind, of course, because the mind is the thing that's trying to know, but it can't really know anything, and so then they're trying to get to this. A sacred authority complex, well, you know, and be told the truth and come back with it, but it doesn't work in my opinion because precisely because they're changing the body chemistry, and it's temporary. So, what's it worth? You might have had this moment of total certainty. When you come back, it's gone.
Yeah, and if you, it's like any other drug, then you become, unfortunately, you become dependent on the psychedelics, and then it ends up causing more harm than good.
I think so, in my experience, and I think that they are, they do generate a kind of dependency which is not similar to heroin. It's more of a, what's more mysterious, let's say, like the plant has a certain hold over us because it's, we've taken it into our bodies in order for it to show us something, and then it, and then we, this can happen with gurus as well, of course, we become dependent on that as an authority. There you have it, a sacred authority complex. We have to keep eating the plant, or even if we don't eat the plant, we have to refer, we, it becomes a paradigm, becomes a framework by which we frame the transcendental.
Yeah, what comes to mind is, do you remember the movie Young Guns from the late 80s?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, do you remember the part where they're lost
and
they're sitting around the fire, and it's Chavez, he's in school, he's schooling them on peyote. We're lost, and so I need to tap into the spirit world.
Yeah.
And they all drink the peyote, but then the next morning all of them are in these demented states. He's the only one that's got some kind of clarity.
Yeah, yeah.
That always sticks in my mind when people talk about the psychedelics. Not simply because it's different for every person, and I think what they were doing in the movie is to underscore the fact of kind of how ridiculous it is, but also Chavez only uses it in this one specific instance. The rest of the time he is not dependent on it.
Yeah.
And even that, and is that not the case with the Native Americans, is that they're not so flippant about the use of the psychedelics. It's very controlled and only used in certain contexts where they would even go there.
And that was a practical context that you cited there.
Yeah.
As in to know the environment better.
Right. Okay. So I'll go to the last section of the introduction. So he talks about himself, part of the reason why he chose to go in this direction. So he says on page 14, this is because the phenomenon of paradox is virtually invisible in our culture. For the common understanding of breaking with the dominant analytical paradigm of Western thought is to shift to Gnostic insight, some form of mysticism or mythological thinking. This, quote, transpersonal viewpoint has no lack of enthusiasts, and I am not saying it is without a certain truth. I argued as much many years ago in The Reenchantment of the World, though thankfully I put in a strong qualification regarding the politics of ecstasy at the end of the book. Then he continues, as the years went by, however, I began to have doubts about oceanic solutions or about the excitement over a, quote, paradigm shift that might usher in a new age. Skipping. Years of body work and meditation led me to believe that paradigm zeal is rooted in a denial of our somatic experience. Emotions, often painful, live in the body. Paradigm shift addiction, like substance addiction, enables us to escape these emotions and live in our heads.
Right. Yes, it's kind of the next level to the geographical cure, isn't it? As in the alcoholic who thinks if he moves to another country or city, he won't drink anymore. Taken into a more, into a subtler realm, like if we can just change the way we think, somehow it will change our reality. Obviously, there's a whole industry around that. It's called the New Age, pretty much. And I agree, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because our minds don't, they might define our experience of reality, but they certainly don't define reality. And so if you just keep changing your paradigm, it's just moving the furniture around, really. Like, it doesn't change the structure of the building.
Yes, that saying, wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah, well, there's this illusion that you think you are, right? It's still there, telling you, I'm better now, I'm more spiritual.
Yeah. Okay, so he continues in that paragraph. Carl Jung and the transpersonalists, despite some valuable insights, are cut off from bodily experience. They created a larger mind than the dominant intellectual paradigm, but when all was said and done, it was still a mind.
Right.
Their call for a renewed spirituality only went so far, in my view. Clearly, we needed a renewed corporeality if we were not going to repress the body and fall into the trap of a new mythology, make a fetish out of our supposedly new spirituality. All of this became the subject of a subsequent book, Coming to Our Senses, the writing of which was an important journey for me.
Yeah, so that passage you just read might have made it into Prisoner Infinity, if I read it, because it's so close to the thesis there.
Yeah. Okay. So then going to the next page, he returns to sedentism, staying in place. He says, as I shall argue later on, being nomadic is something that culturally and physiologically reinforces kaleidoscopic or paradoxical perception. For the landscape is constantly shifting before one. Fixed abodes lend themselves to fixed perceptions, as well as a need for certainty, both religious and political. Given that the bulk of human experience on this earth is ambulatory, it seems likely that beneath our desperate need for certainty lies something much deeper. Then that is our need for indeterminism, for the world to be unpredictable, surprising, alive. So one way to read this is that although we say that we want certainty, we really don't want it.
Yeah, same with security too. Because the security, I joked this recently, if you want security, get yourself thrown in jail, because that's the ultimate security. And the so the kind of lifestyle and even the kind of society we've established with this prioritization of security is more and more restrictive. I mean, actually, I wrote a script a little bit about this, about an OCD guy who was so threatened by what you just described there, kind of unpredictable nature of existence, that he structured every single day exactly the same, so that he would never do anything different, you know, for the rest of his life. That was his attempt, his goal. So, but even, you know, that's an extreme case, of course, but most of us in the Western world have strictly structured lives and routines, and we obviously, you know, stay in our apartment or go from our apartment to our car to our workplace. It's all very secure, but it's very oppressive. It becomes oppressive, and now it's actually becoming you know, much more palpably manifest with the COVID crackdown, which, as you mentioned at the start, seems to be not so much amplifying our fear, I would say, as revealing, you know, how much our society is driven around fear, and specifically the fear of death. And that, 'cause that's the security, I think, isn't it? That people are seeking is security from death, which, of course, there isn't any security from death.
Or annihilation would be another way to look at it. But what I wanted to say to that is, I can think of when I was younger, and I certainly would say this is certainly more so the case of younger people today, is that there's too much uncertainty and too much unpredictability, which is overwhelming for them. So I know, because you and I are close to the same age, having lived enough in life where there are certain things that I can tolerate and other things that I can't tolerate. And I work much better within certain parameters because, as you said, if I wanted true certainty, then I would go sit in a jail cell, which is not what I want. But when you have parameters and you can move within those parameters, but the parameters also help define what you're working with, such as, you're driving in a destination, you have an interstate or you have side roads to go down, versus you're trying to choose your own path. Now, of course, deploying Berman's thesis here is that, primitive peoples, they just moved. They didn't have any specific roads, or maybe later on they developed roads because that was more of a sense of predictability where they wanted to get to and what they needed to do. But those parameters help provide some semblance of security, but nobody wants true security or true certainty. They want the flux and they want to move within certain parameters. Depends on the person. Some want a lot more structure, other ones want less structure.
Well, there is no such thing as true security, is there? So no one could want it. Well, I suppose people do want things that don't exist, but I mean, no one could know what it was like if they got it.
Yeah, they wouldn't know. Okay, and so closing out that section with the introduction, he says, I am not arguing that paradox is our destiny. Again, paradox is the diffuse tension. Certainly, we are at a critical juncture as a civilization, and everybody seems to be saying this in one form or another these days. For me, there are at least two problems with this. First, I am not convinced that the human race actually has a quote destiny. I am not convinced. sorry, some sort of fate that is written down somewhere, which God, Hegel, and a few mystics have been privileged to know. There may be no unconscious purpose working itself out. Life may just be life, going through various turns, occasionally hitting a dead end, sometimes making progress, and sometimes not. Second, I am no longer convinced that the institution of some new paradigm can really save us. Such a thing may come to pass, but like all the previous paradigms, it too will have its problems. They too will be severe, and we shall have to deal with them as best we can. Perhaps destiny ought to be replaced by the notion that there is better and there is worse, and that's just the way things are.
A contradiction in there as you were reading it. I was reading it too, and this might be pedantry again, but perhaps not, which is, he says sometimes we make progress and sometimes we don't, and I would, it makes me wonder if without the idea of a destiny, could we have an idea of progress?
Well, I mean, there are certain commentators nowadays who call into question the idea of progress.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking of John Michael Greer, whom I've listened to extensively too. He certainly has criticized the notion of progress.
Yeah, I think it's up for grabs now, and I have too. Of course, it's become a defining myth for us in the Western world, progress, no doubt. So, but I don't think Berman was using it that way. It's just the idea of human progress. I think it would be very hard for us as individuals to conceive of a way of being that didn't have a sense of progress, and which actually now I'm thinking that's also relates to right and wrong, like what's right for me and what's wrong for me. we absolutely need to have that awareness to survive. Obviously, if we do really crazy, stupid things, we end up dead. But in terms of having the best experience of being here that we can have, it's very difficult to use words at this point. It's a huge subject, actually. It's talking about not just morality, value, you know, the whole thing of values. Where would we be without values? You can't not have some sense of values. And I would say that the goal is to align our sense of value with reality. Of course, the postmodernists would just sniff at that and say, well, there is no reality except what you value. I don't know what they would say, but they would say something that anyway, but so, and so even what Berman's writing about there, this book is about largely, I think, how can we bring horizontality or a horizontal experience of existence and a paradox back into the world, which I interpret as being more embodied, being at peace, at ease with death, or being able to live with death awareness, being connected to our environment, being connected to community, or a number of other things, but I'm losing them now. But anyway, and so that's a goal. Like he is positing a goal in this book. He even ends with a point about that, like maybe you'll be the person to help bring this about. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think he's being hypocritical or anything like that. But, and I think the passage that you just read, he's not really saying, well, we don't have a destiny. He's just saying, well, I don't know and I don't need to know. That's what I got from that, which is good, healthy, I would say. I sort of feel the same way, but at the same time, I don't personally feel that I could live without a sense, it's making me think of Deva Shana now, I was going to say, without a sense of what I'm aspiring to. Even if I don't know what it is, at least I know when I'm getting closer to it. So being more embodied, let's say, being more relaxed, being more connected to the environment, being able to connect to others, and so on. It made me think of David Shana, because he said the only reason he really knew that the only reason he called it enlightenment was that he'd been seeking enlightenment from the age of 5 to the age of 33 when it happened, and that when whatever it was happened, he wasn't seeking anymore. He just felt, he just had the experience that he was no longer seeking. So that the liberation from that forward seeking drive to get somewhere or attain something, maybe the very nature of, you know, enlightenment or arriving or progress, to get to a point where we no longer need to progress or need or to believe in progress, and I'm not at it, so I do still have this sense of I'm trying to get to somewhere, and then I can relax that. And I know it's paradoxical, it's like it's because I'm trying to get to a place where I'm not trying to get anywhere, but I also feel that it correlates with a felt sense in my body, a very visceral experience of disquiet, of being ill at ease, because I'm not fully in my body, because my life force isn't fully distributed in my body, and as within, so without, I'm not at harmony with my environment. I can walk through the forest and I won't notice hardly anything. My wife's helped me to see how little I notice, because she does really tune in and notice things. And I don't think that should be a discipline, because it's some spiritual discipline so that we enter a new paradigm. But I think it's a mark of, or one of the many marks, and they would be somewhat specific to each of us, of being here, of actually being here, being embodied. And I can't see how that couldn't be a goal. As in, you know, we were born a body was created through another body, or through the combination of two other bodies, and we were born, and there was a portion of life force or awareness that this body was created to house, that correspond, and it didn't make it all the way in, because the trauma, this is a loose hypothesis, but it's what I believe. Then I can't see how that could not be a goal, and therefore there is this progress. this idea of progress that's very different from the Western idea, because it's just about how can we get here. Now, the Western thing believes we're already here, but the world is somehow not the right world, and so we have to keep fixing it and making it a better place. And I would say, well, we can't ever really change the world in any positive sense until we're fully here. But also I'd say that once we're fully here, that's it. The world will take care of itself. We'll experience the world in a totally different way. And so that, it seems to me, that's the destiny. Well, destiny implies something that's going to happen, but that's the potential of humanity. And I don't think it contradicts Berman's thesis. I think his thesis is about that. Like, how can we actually, can we fulfill our potential?
Right, I agree with that. It's paradoxical. The destiny is to be right where you are, not be somewhere else.
Yeah, and then things happen from that. Sure, I'm not saying that things wouldn't happen that would look like progress from the outside, but from the inside, maybe it's similar to the hunter-gatherer, this image I had of their moving through the wilderness. Not like the Jews, because they had a destination, just because that's what they do, and because they're hungry, and well, they know that they will be hungry, so there's a combination of two things. And most of the time they're in unfocused awareness. I mean, I don't want to project theory of mind onto this, but let's just say there's a natural enjoyment in being part of nature, and so they're in it. But then at certain points, for different reasons, they get very focused, and I've got to get that barrier, I've got to kill that wild animal, and all their forces kind of rally to that goal, and then they fulfill it, and then they're back in. So there's two things, aren't there? There's just being, as you said, just being here, but then there's what can happen and what we can accomplish from a fully embodied state. I'm quite sure that would be absolutely marvelous to behold. But it wouldn't be about, once we build these bridges and create these institutions, everyone will be happy. It would be more like the bees making honey. It's simply part of what they do because they're bees.
Maybe bee nature.
Yeah, the bee nature. I was gonna say, maybe I'm being a bit romantic here, but I'm trying not to be.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go to the next chapter.
Yeah, chapter one, you mean. We're starting.
Chapter one. So I want to skip to the section where he says the birth of the ego.
Yeah, okay.
This is on page 35.
Yeah, good.
Okay, I have a couple points there. Okay, in the first paragraph he says, as far as object relations theory goes, what we are talking about is the emergence of cognition, specifically the crystallization of an ego, or self-conscious awareness out of an unconscious matrix. A newborn human, and we can assume this is the case for an infant born in the Paleolithic caves of southern France, as well as for one born in a hospital in Paris. And with the Paleolithic cave, he's referring to the Lascaux caves. Does that make much of a distinction between self, capital S, and other, capital O? Although much has been written by now on the infant's ability to recognize parents very early on, the ability to imitate gestures and so on, mimesis, I guess, it is doubtful that this and related abilities represent true self-awareness or interiority, that is, the consciousness of one's own consciousness. What has been called the, quote, psychological birth of the human infant typically occurs during the third year of life, when the child realizes that he or she is a separate entity, a self in a world of others. This is the core of object relations. Standing in front of a mirror now, the child knows that the, quote, playmate in the glass is really, quote, me, a specular image. But this realization does not happen at all once. Self-awareness is a non-linear process, something that grows and fits and starts. In the presence of an existential identity with a reflective internal life, something that does not happen for the rest of the animal kingdom, takes a bit of time to stabilize. If the truth be told, it is a process that is never really complete.
So he, I don't know how specific he gets, but he is positing, I mean, he's describing this process as a way to posit that this happened for us collectively as well as it happens for us individually. Would you agree?
Yes. Yeah. I also think he's, well, he doesn't, I don't think he specifically calls out Lacan, but this is the mirror stage.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I only know about, I mean, the part I wrote in Prisoner of Infinity about that is about all I know about it. It's not as though I'd read Lacan for 10 years and then it was just that I was working on Prisoner of Infinity and looking for evidence for my thesis, and I found Lacan's mirror stage. So that's pretty much all I know about it, is what you read in Prisoner of Infinity.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's one of those things that just, I felt, aha, you know, okay, I know that.
Right. So, well, he specifically references object relations here.
Yeah,
that's
which is, is that Winnicott?
Yes, Winnicott. I think it's Melanie Klein too. Yeah.
Right.
Klein and Winnicott.
So, did you have more to say about that or ask? Or?
Yeah, let me, oh, here it is in the second paragraph. I'll go ahead and read it. He says, in any case, the process event of understanding that you are, quote, in here, and that the other person, or in general, your environment, is, quote, out there, is the birth of individual identity, but also of alienation from the world. The birth of real self-awareness tears the psyche in two, creates what one psychologist, Jacques Lacan, called the gap, or what another, Michael Balint, referred to as the basic fault. A lot of how this is negotiated depends on the immediate surroundings, and if they are benevolent, so much the better for our feelings of being at home in the world. But there is always a tear, a pulling away from a primal unity, and it is in the search to mend that, to fill in the gap, that much of our sacred yearning is rooted. A, quote, lived distance now divides us from the world. In varying degrees, we find it painful. I would also add is that probably those who have been traumatized, abused from an early age, have much more of a gap, perhaps even a chasm, that it takes a lot of work, and probably they can never close the gap that way.
Well, absolutely, I'd agree, and I don't remember him getting into trauma a great deal in this book.
Well, he talks about child rearing later on.
He does mention showering. It's certainly acknowledged. I'm not saying he just skips over it. I'm just meaning he certainly doesn't centralize it, even though you could say the whole book is about trauma.
So
I agree. I obviously would second that, and with the addition that you're talking about possibly everybody on the planet pretty much now, when if you're talking about severe trauma, even with the birthing methods, I think it's pretty severe. One thing that occurred to me, though, and again, I might be being pedantic, but I find it can be useful to split, well, not to split hairs, but to just zero in on things that maybe seem minor but aren't, which is when he says, the birth of real self-awareness tears the psyche into, creates the gap. I wonder if that's an unnecessary assumption, like making correlation cause, because wouldn't it be also possible to say that when the psyche splits in two, this creates self-awareness? Do we know, like, which comes first?
Right. So if a two-year-old saw itself in the mirror, would the same process happen? I mean, he focuses on age three, which I suppose is, you know, a given at the time in the psychoanalytical literature, is that this is when one really becomes self-aware that they're distinct from others and distinct from the world at large. There's something separate.
Yeah, but so, I mean, because it's getting worse, isn't it? So self-awareness, awareness of self, we're correlating with the, I think we are anyway, with the existence of self, with an identity self. Which would seem to me where the problem begins, as compared to a three-year-old becoming aware that the person in the mirror is them. If you see what I mean that, because that's practical awareness. I mean, some cats know that, many of them, most of them probably, because they smell. They just know. Doesn't mean they develop an ego.
Right.
So I just wonder if that's a bit fuzzy, that this terminology here, because Dave O'Shana certainly has self-awareness. He's aware that he's a self, but he describes his experience in ways that persuade me, let's say, that he doesn't have a sense of existing as a separate identity. He experiences himself as connected to others in a way that doesn't allow for him to maintain or feed the idea of this I that we talked about before. I mean, I'm getting all garbled with language because it's so difficult, but hopefully you got my point. Did you get my point?
Well, it sounds like you're saying he's not obsessed with the sense of an ego.
Well, it's more than that. It's that he, and I don't know if it's better to use an example or not, because some people be rolling their eyes going, oh, well, he just says he's enlightened and they don't believe it. But whatever, I mean, just make it hypothetical if you're skeptical about this particular individual. But he describes what happened to him was that he had spent the 30 years or so, or since the age of three, perhaps, I don't know, existing inside his mind, like his awareness was confined to his mind, and so everything his mind was experiencing and telling him, he took that as reality, including the I am this and I do this and all that. I am Dave. And what happened on this morning that he supposedly woke up, became enlightened, was that his awareness came out of his mind. He escaped from the prison of his mind, if you want to use the metaphor. And so he's experiencing himself, his awareness in his body rather than confined to his mind. He hadn't lost his mind, but he was no longer in it. But what he had lost was that he realized that the identity that he had been living with was not real. It was gone. He actually couldn't find it. As in, this person I thought I was, oh my God, I'm not that person. They don't exist, rather. They actually don't exist, which I think you and I can theoretically say, yeah, okay, I can believe that. But we can't, so far, I can't have a lived experience of that. So my self-awareness is inseparable from this gap. I feel the gap. Whereas Dave still has self-awareness, clearly, but the gap has closed for him. So, and I presume Berman would allow that, or Lacan for that matter. They wouldn't say that if you can heal the gap, you no longer have self-awareness. I presume they wouldn't say that.
Right. What comes to mind is I'm drawing on my philosophical experience with phenomenology. So Edmund Husserl was the inventor, you could say, of 20th century phenomenology, and he talked about definitely consciousness and the intentionality of consciousness is a focused on something. Consciousness is always focused on something, and then later on he talked about what he termed the transcendental ego, which is that there's something behind consciousness that is observing, like a super awareness. So the argument there is, yes, when one is in the typical standpoint, I forget the exact term, that you are taking the world as it is. Here's a pen on my desk, here's my notepad, here's the monitor that I'm looking into as I talk with you. But then if I bracket the phenomenological bracket, I start to see things that are not pre-described, prescribed. So I'm looking at something that is an object for consciousness. And the ego, something that I believe is the source of the consciousness, actually is being perceived by something that's behind it.
Right.
So
Yeah.
that's the transcendental ego. And he was pilloried for that in later on, but the when I definitely at the time that I was getting into phenomenology, there was a lots of parallels between the Buddhist awareness. So, something else I wanted to bring up earlier on is that definitely a core tenet in Buddhism is the Two Truths doctrine, as they call it, which is there's conventional reality, that the things that are in the world we apply names to, but those are conventional. Sure, we call this thing a pen, we call this thing an apple, but it does not capture what it is. Nor should we ever make the mistake of assuming that whatever we name is the essence of it. And then the other truth is that there's the other world that is not part of conventional reality. That's kind of it in a nutshell. So this whole thing about, what brings to mind as you're describing with Dave is that he just woke up one day realizing is that I, Dave Oshana, and not who I think I am. Not as an alternate identity, but as that I realize that Dave Oshana is a name that I apply to myself, but it doesn't capture exactly who I am. Does that make sense? Is that close to
Yeah, and I think, and you've made the, I think, seemed like the right correlation there was that the we think the mind is a source of awareness, but actually, it's not. Awareness is also outside the mind, and a portion of awareness has got confined to the mind, and then the mind, by some weird freakish configuration, has developing an identity thereby identified itself as the source of awareness.
Right, and then it becomes a homunculus,
Yeah.
a small individual that's in a body, which is a machine, that's a vehicle ferrying it from place to place, rather than, there's also other Western philosophers that focus more on the body, corporeality, where,
Yeah.
Merleau-Ponty comes to mind, the French phenomenologist, that is, he definitely focuses a lot more on the body as influencing perception and awareness of the world.
And I think that this comes back to horizontality and verticality too, because the homunculus lives in our head, behind our eyes. So it is the sacred authority complex that's internalized, as you could say. It's diabolical, really. But anyway, I think the sacred authority complex always is a kind of counterfeit, I think, of the true sacred. That's my sense. The religious people are not going to want to hear that. But anyway. The verticality, yeah, so the head, and then the body is just the thing that carries the head around, as compared to what you're saying, the full bodily awareness, where we experience our self, our awareness, as fully distributed through the body. So I am just as much in my feet, or in my kidneys, or in my nostrils, or in my butthole, as I am behind my eyes. And that, I think, that's more getting more verticality. And then that, I mean, sorry, horizontality, and then that would naturally extend to how the body is embedded in an environment, which is nature, but specifically human nature, because that's our species. So we're all, as human beings who are fully embodied, we may discover that we're as connected as bees in a hive, or birds in murmuration, or mushrooms in the forest, which are connected, or trees connected by roots. So then that would be full horizontality then, like we experience ourselves really existing perceptually and as awareness, distributed throughout the whole body, and thereby throughout the whole species.
Right. If only we could just push the ego aside.
Yeah, if only. I mean, because that's a whole other thing, isn't it? Because there's all these second ma this whole second matrix architecture, which is supposedly, is what Berman's saying about the Gnostic key, that we realize that we're trapped in this. I can't remember how he described it before the Gnostic key, but anyway, we're trapped in this reductionist perspective and experience. So we think we've got to go to mysticism and Gnosticism, but then that's what I call the second matrix, where we think there are certain practices or beliefs whereby if we reconfigure the mind in the right way, we'll somehow transcend the ego. And I think a lot of them just make the ego stronger, actually. Well, they kind of turbo boost it, which is very much what Prisoner Infinity is about.
Yeah, as I said, I was reading through it more in depth this past week, and lots of times I just shook my head at Strieber's descriptions. And reading your descriptions too, is that I couldn't help but think at some point, is that the guy's nuts.
I know I said that recently.
Really, how could anybody have taken that stuff seriously? I mean, the whole thing with the anal probe, okay, that's a running joke. It's been around for a long time. But some of the other things that he describes, that he's abducted and he's alone and terrified, or these, that small human that was outside his door smoking cigarettes, it's just like the guy's nuts. You couldn't help but think that.
I know. Well, I said that recently on a podcast, and I didn't retract it, but I qualified it because it's not an ordinary kind of nuts. It's this particular kind that that Berman's writing about is this.
Yeah, he's nuts, but he what's the word I'm looking for? The I wouldn't say sincerity, but the investment in all of that is just it's become his life.
Yeah, and he's generating his own proofs to some degree,
Yeah.
if only in writing books that people believe and that are believable. And I don't think he's making it up. I don't think it's that kind of nuts. I think it's the kind of nuts of squishing the whole horizontal experience of being one with everything into this vertical prism, where he gets to be the one, and I know how that feels. Through
Yeah.
which this transcendental truth is coming, and it's scarily convincing in a way. Like I bought into it because he is representing something real, and I think Berman allows us too. I mean, the mystical states and experiences, and even the sacred authority complex, they wouldn't have such power if they weren't glimpses of something real that we have, or even maybe direct experiences, but not lasting ones that we've then pulled down into the mind and conceptualized and then kind of imposed on reality. I mean, literally, that's Berman's thesis, isn't it? Or part of it is it's complementary with Hayden's thesis, that the socio-political structures that have been created and then imposed upon the earth and human organisms, they're all sourced in this glimpse of heaven.
Right, and then with Hayden and the aggrandizers, there are certain groups of people that can see the potential for exercising power through that.
Yeah.
So then one wonders, where does the desire come from them to do that?
Well, it's complementary, isn't it? Because if the access to slash generation of a sacred authority complex is part of finding temporary security because of the paralyzing alienation of entering the gap, then the very urge that has driven us into, or the drive that's driven us into those experiences, which is a feeling of being powerless or abandoned, then determines how we will use them. Which is to get power over others.
Right,
That's been
right.
my thesis throughout 16 Maps of Hell. It really was wrestling with it to the very end, to the last pages, and where Berman's thing came in, because it's a part of one way of looking at it is trying to have control over the mother's body as an infant who's being forced to separate and feeling alienated and terrified, but then also threatened by the mother's body and her psyche. Does this paralyzing, well, it can develop into an overwhelming need to have, and it presumably would be a need as an infant to have control over the mother's body, to get her to do what you want and be there when you want her and not be there when you don't want her to be there. Anyone who's been married knows what that feels like. I mean, a man. So that creates adults who have a pathological need to have control over their environment, total control over their environment. And like Ed Gein, the famous serial killer, they will even try and recreate the world in the image of their mother's body. It's like they're trying to recreate the womb slash the mother's body so that they can re-experience it in the way that they wanted to. Basically, yeah, I mean, we see that with obviously, the power over nature, the domination of nature, but it's in the whole of society, the way that society's been created and configured, I'd say, is a an acting out of that womb, or that wound.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a bit of a riff, but are you going to go back to the text now?
Yeah, I was going to go to the section, The Birth of Culture. This is still in the first chapter.
Okay, so then I finally get to have a go, because this is my first the first part that I've noted, which is on
Okay.
page 37. I don't know what it is, so I'll just read it to find out. What then is this distinct psychology, this new generic type of personality organization that emerged during the late Paleolithic? Although I believe Julian James's dating of these events is very much off, he places it at 1300 to 900 BC. His description of this new consciousness is one of the best I have come across. Briefly, James's principal characterization of the new mental configuration is that of a metaphorical mind space, including a sense of past and future, which allows us to see ourselves in the story of our lives. In other words, when we are conscious in this self-reflective sense, we possess what he calls an analog eye, a metaphor we have of ourselves that can move about in our imagination. We see this imago, this self, doing things in the world, that is in space and time, and on this basis we make decisions regarding the imagined outcomes that would be impossible if we couldn't imagine this self. So I think most of that we've covered. I guess I marked it because it sums up a lot, but also because it includes this thing of becoming an avatar, the central to this self-awareness that's related to the mirror state, as in we recognize ourselves in an image, is that we create an internal image. And that this is it seems to me that this is a natural faculty of the human organism based on survival, to create an image of itself and then project the image into a simulation of the environment that it's in, to see what happens to that image, as he says, to imagine possible futures, scenarios. But again, if that becomes, if that faculty, you could say the dissociative ability, if it gets overstimulated, or if it becomes coupled with a need to escape overwhelming trauma, which is a tautology, but intense trauma, another tautology, trauma, then we end up using it for escape rather than simply to work things out. We just say, oh, actually, I can go in there and play. You know, I can just go in there and hide. And creates an interesting image to me, actually, of just imagining ourselves just, you know, in a comfy bed watching TV, which is kind of what we're doing in our lives a lot of the time. And that, so there's this overlap where we're going into this imaginary world, or a simulation of the world with our imaginary self, to escape, but also to imagine possible scenarios. And in that world, this is scenario planning, we imagine scenarios that we then try and bring about. And so we've created a world over time where we're actually doing that literally and physically. We're literally creating images of ourselves and we're projecting them into simulated realms.
it sure make you blind.
I can advance a couple of examples here. So somebody that is, quote, healthy, and we use that term reservedly, would be, as you said, well, I can imagine myself lying in bed lazily on a Sunday morning with the rain outside, and that's pleasant feelings. Or I'm looking forward to going for a hike tomorrow, weather permitting. Okay, so this projection to the next day and my imagining myself walking through a pine forest in the cool breeze, wishing past my face. Okay, and that brings up good feelings for me, and I'm really looking forward to that. Then on a slightly more, we say, neurotic level, is somebody that has had bad luck in trying to find a job after being unemployed. So then they start to map and are very sensitive to changes in the other person's voice or changes in actions on the other side. And they are trying to anticipate some harm or something changing at a moment's notice. So that way they are steeled against any kind of disappointment or any kind of harmful turn of things. And then you take an extreme example, and what comes to mind is Strieber, who is using his imagination to construct this elaborate world that he is the center of, but trying to do that to really escape a trauma that he's not fully aware of, and certainly fully not acknowledging it.
Sorry, I lost you there for a second. I didn't want to interrupt because I knew it was still recording, but I lost sound, so I had to change headset. So I only caught some of that.
Well, I'll quickly repeat is that at two ends of a spectrum, you could say somebody who is looking forward to go hiking tomorrow, weather permitting, and they can imagine themselves in a pine forest walking, seeing mountains in the distance and feeling the breeze and so on. So they're putting themselves in a certain scenario and they're really looking forward to it because that gives them warm feelings. Versus on the opposite end of the spectrum, and I would take it as an extreme example, Strieber's world that he's constructed to escape trauma, he's at the center of it, but yet he's trapped by it. So he's using his imagination, you could say, in a perverse sense.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Well, yes. As a succinct summary of it, although I think we all do that. I mean, that was my point, that we're in a culture that has perverted the use of the imagination so drastically that we have the kind of world that we have, and I don't think we need to go into the specifics of it necessarily, but it does seem to all come back to the body or not, or to the disembodiment. And you know, if we're using our imagination to escape the body, then it's probably a perversion of the imagination. It's not corresponding with anything real.
Okay, so was there anything else that you had to read from the text?
That was it. Yeah, let's go to your next one.
Okay, so on the next page, page 38, The Birth of Culture.
Yeah.
So in the third paragraph, he says, what is perhaps most striking about this compilation, at least in my mind, is how logarithmic the cultural development is. The bulk of the action occurs when the modern Cro-Magnon human being, or Homo sapiens sapiens, appears on the scene. In fact, the relative suddenness and recentness of human culture has been commented on for decades now. Beginning with Kruber, this is A.L. Kruber, scholars had not been able to separate the dramatic developments of the Upper Paleolithic from the nature, and possibly evolution, of mind, no matter how elusive the latter may be. For what we see in the artifacts is the physical expression of human consciousness, even if interpretation is nearly always controversial or difficult. So I think he's going back to an earlier point where, particularly with Homo sapiens sapiens, which is what we are, that it's, you know, I've seen this elsewhere before, is that how did consciousness emerge and why did it emerge? Mm-hmm. Well, nobody can really explain either one of those. It just did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was one of those, it's one of those things. It's, it just seemed to appear out of nowhere. Whether it was placed there, you know, we don't get into speculations about that. But then ever since that time, that's been, it's been having to deal with that. And, you know, he's, through his speculations here, is that what did things look like over the past several millennia to get us to this point, stretching back to when consciousness emerged and imagination and self-awareness emerged?
Okay, well, I could respond to that, but I'm also we've probably got about 15 minutes before I have to go. We're definitely going to want to do a part two. So I was hoping maybe we could get to the end of at least the first chapter. Is that, do you have lots of notes?
No, lots of notes. I can, let me do a quick scan here for something that steps in. Okay.
You think we could get through this chapter in the next 15 minutes?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
All right, so I'm skipping to page 42.
Okay.
This is still in The Birth of Culture. At the bottom of the page, he says, civilization, in any case, means more than just art. It also means the existence of a social organization capable of passing knowledge on from one generation to the next, which was clearly going on if, as was indeed the case, the people of the Upper Paleolithic Europe had a body of technical knowledge as sophisticated as that of any modern HG, hunter-gatherer. In general, the pattern from around 35,000 years is one of almost continual change. Then he continues, what we see in all of these events, technology, burials, adornment, hunting, and artistic symbolic representation, is basically a shift from the exterior world to the mind. It is essentially with the rise of modern Homo sapiens that ideas about non-material phenomena, such as death or personal identity, began to get externalized. Before this, the limit of cognitive ability was the externalization of ideas pertaining to physical material alone. Neurally modern humans, according to Randall White, it's a controversial point, emerged by around 100,000 years, after which we start to see the slow imposition of a mental form on the external world. Image-driven constructional action, as Peter Reynolds calls it. Culture, in essence, involves self-consciousness, self-conscious awareness, and intent. By the time we arrive at the Neolithic with the planting of grain, the experimentation with animal domestication, and the almost constant preoccupation with survival, activities that involve enormous degrees of planning depth, paradox is virtually lost. Feeling at home in the world is now going to require stronger spiritual medicine, religion, in fact.
Right. So, how would you define paradox then? And I mean, the way that he's using it.
The diffuse awareness.
Yeah, but why is that a paradox?
Paradox. Now let's see, what does he say earlier?
Because my sense, we can just guess our way through it as well, is that paradox has to do with being aware that one exists, but also that one won't exist for long, and that what one is embedded in is more real than oneself.
Well, here's what he says on page 9 in the introduction. I call this consciousness paradoxical because it is simultaneously focused and non-focused. It is hovering or peripheral rather than intense or ecstatic. And paradox also exists in the fact that a moment such as this feels completely individual and unique and at the same time universal. As a result, that which is most personal is also felt to be the most general, the most connected to other human beings. In addition, that which is fleeting is experienced as that which is most enduring.
Right. So, I mean, one could extend it to just about everything. The paradox is somehow the nature of existence. And I don't think this is probably the case for my cat. I think it's only with self-awareness that paradox becomes central to our experience, if we're honest about it or if we're aware enough. Because self-awareness is awareness of our body, and that is going to die. Right? And even if we think, well, I am my mind, unless you're a transhumanist, or I suppose a Christian who somehow thinks, I mean, actually, there's all kinds of religious, but anyway, the I that is our mind is going to die with our body. So essentially, it's the death of the body that means the death of the I. And so the awareness of self, therefore, is awareness of death. And well, I think there's an inherent paradox somehow experientially in that, because we don't feel like we're going to die, and we don't feel like we're only temporary, even though we know it. I feel like I've always been here and that I always will be.
Right.
And I think Devashana would say the same, based on a lot more experience than me. Like, for me, it's partly delusional, I know that, but I also think there's something in there that's real, that the world, if we use the world in its transcendental sense, as in existence, will always exist. It has to be, because otherwise it would have gone by now. If it's still around now, it must always be around, just mathematically speaking.
Right, and then you get into questions of, was the world created, or was the world always there?
Yeah, well, you can if you want. I wasn't going to go. I was going to go there. I was going to go to.
Another one of the paradoxes is the self and the other. So, I have the awareness that I am something distinct from others, but at the same time, I am part of others.
Yeah. Well, the environment, as I say, environment includes others as well.
Or something philosophically like the problem of other minds. I have a mind, something that I call a mind, and so you have a mind.
Well, yeah, theory of mind. So, and that is just an assumption, of course, and it may be that it's a self-sustaining collective assumption / delusion. And I think that was close to where I was going to get to, which is that I just lost it again, but it was to do with the consciousness, this thing about consciousness. Again, if we attribute a consciousness to the mind, or if we make them equivalent, even if we go mind at large, we make this very big mind via the second matrix, then we're imposing something on reality that isn't necessarily equivalent to reality. It's an imposition. Because mind, I mean, clearly the body is conscious or aware in ways that the mind aren't. For example, the heartbeat, the mind doesn't control that or even notice it. So if we allow that consciousness extends beyond the mind and isn't confined to the mind or even dependent on a mind, and if by mind we think of this self-awareness complex, then this whole question of consciousness and where it came from and when it entered into might be asked backwards, because there was probably consciousness even in human, well, including obviously in human organisms, before there was mind. This is Julian James's hypothesis. So it wasn't really the introduction of consciousness, but the introduction of the gap. And so then we could just see that in history, that at a certain point culture started developing as a, perhaps hypothesizing as a bulwark against the awareness of death / the experience of alienation. And so we've created a civilization out of this self, you could say self-consciousness is a better phrase than self-awareness. Actually, that would be quite a good dichotomy, because self-awareness is healthy, self-consciousness is inhibiting and can drive us into very stupid behaviors. And most people don't have self-awareness, I think. I haven't met most people, but most people I've met, and I work in a thrift store, don't have much self-awareness. Whereas self-consciousness is everywhere. People are inhibited the whole time. How do I look? How do I appear? You know, how am I coming across? All that. And anyway, the larger point I wanted to make was that what if consciousness is in everything? And what we're calling the origin of consciousness was more to do with the origin of alienation, as in we started to lose touch, and this is Berman's thesis probably in the reenchantment of the world, or the disenchantment, we started to lose touch with the sacred dimension of existence itself, which is that consciousness is indwelling. and that we're part of consciousness rather than consciousness being part of us. Now, I mean, that sounds like mysticism, so I'm not entirely happy with the way I had to articulate that. But anyway, I'll leave it as it stands.
It's not just mysticism, it's idealism.
Well, that's even worse.
Philosophical idealism, but depends on how you spin that, because there's personal idealism, there is absolute idealism, there are many flavors of it.
Okay, yeah, you're using it in a specific sense. I think of idealism as being an idealist, which is very dangerous stuff.
No, not that kind of idealist.
Okay, all right, yeah, you got the philosophical lingo.
Yeah.
But anyway, I didn't want to posit it as some mystical panacea, but just as a different framework for the origin of consciousness, as a counterpoint, anyway, to that passage.
Sure, and that thesis, at least to me, doesn't strike me as absurd, because again, one thing is that what's the way you define consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
That we're thinking it's something that showed up in the mind, or it's an epiphenomenon of the brain. Well, that's one definition of it. Or is it something that, you know, you talk about the life force, and even going back to the Greeks about the psyche, the life force that's there, that's within, that animates the body, or type of thing. Sure, that's not for somebody like me that's got the philosophical background. There's many different ways you can spin that. Well, it depends on how you're talking about it. To the average person, you'd be like, well, what do you mean I don't have consciousness? It's in my head. Everything has consciousness. You're talking some mystical mumbo jumbo there.
Yeah, and it kind of arrogantly dismisses the evidence that the body is very, I can't think of the words, because well designed suggests a designer. But well, A, it's consciousness, as I've already said, it's conscious. But B, it's configured in such a way, and the whole universe, that's clearly very efficient, effective. It works, right? So there's clearly, evidentially, there's consciousness behind it. One doesn't have to turn it into God. But anyway, I think, I don't know, is this semantic, or is this central at all to Burma's thesis? Because you know, what we're calling consciousness certainly is a central question. And would relate to how we experience consciousness, because I would say that we're generally not conscious now. But anyway, is it pedantic, or is it an essential distinction then? Because the passage that you read seemed to me about the origin of consciousness. I think it would be better to talk about it as the origin of the gap.
Self-awareness and alienation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The sense that you are not part of.
Yeah,
the wider world.
Yeah, so you actually
going back to his earlier view is that there's the distinction between having a world and having a worldview.
Yeah.
The worldview is a consequence of a sense of alienation.
Yeah, and now you've got a compartmentalized interpretation of the world, and you relate to that. So you've become less conscious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. In fact, and the lack of consciousness causes the alienation, and the alienation causes a further withdrawal from the world.
Right. Okay, so since we're at the end, I just wanted to close out with a couple of few things from the last two pages, 46 and 47.
Okay.
Okay, so Berman says, given the fact that some Angst der Kreatur, creature anxiety, as the German psychologist Karen Horney called it, is always present, and that the mother's role is always crucial. It is nevertheless the case that there is a great deal of lability possible with respect to child-rearing practices and the infant psyches that they shape. But under what would become stress and insecurity of Neolithic life, what is a natural spiritual life, love the world as it presents itself, moves aside to make way for the shaman, for ecstasy, myth, ritual, charisma, and in general, vertical religious experience. The fear of death that is generated by that life, and the altered child-rearing practices that often accompany it, make transcendent solutions and explanations increasingly attractive. As the British psychoanalyst Ernest Jones once put it, the religious life is a dramatization projected onto the cosmos of the fears and desires arriving from the child-parent relation. Causally speaking, it is larger than this, of course, but you get the point.
Mm-hmm. Is that the last passage you're going to read?
One last one. It is only when we examine patterns of comparative child rearing that we are able to obtain a sense of what the other possibilities are and what the sources of this balance might be. So this is a setup for what he had to say about politics and power, and then later on for child rearing.
Okay, so we can save that one for part two then.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the last one. Anything to say about that? Because while I'm thinking, I mean, what's your impression of that passage, the larger one that you read?
Well, again, I think about Prisoner of Infinity, since I just read it this past week, and how there's still a lot of that overlap. But again, as I said at the top of the conversation, is that the, you know, had I read this 20 years ago, it probably would have been new to me. But now, 20 years later, that I'm reading it, it's the thesis. Much of what he covers here doesn't seem to be that new. Because of, okay, so the chief thesis is the difference between horizontality and verticality. Okay. The, you know, what Hayden has to say about the aggrandizers. Okay. Is certain people step in and then they become the go-between. Between the fearful populace and then what they're trying to get to on the other side, a sense of certainty, and only the aggrandizers, the shaman or the mystic, is the one that has the knowledge and the practice, even you could say the talent or the ability to see within those other realms. You know that there's something that's other than this world. This world just can't be it. But the average person doesn't have the wherewithal to get to there, or they're not trained enough. I mean, any fool can take ayahuasca or some other kind of psychedelic and claim that they see within ultimate reality. But the priests or the shamans, they step in and they say, no, you come to us. We're the ones that can translate it for you. I mean, I think about the priests in the Catholic Mass, is that the priests were the only ones for a long time who could speak Latin. Before Vatican II in the Catholic Church, where then it became in the vernacular. So more people could understand what was going on in the Mass.
Well, that's consistent with the need for a relationship with the divine being compromised by damaged parental relations. And I'd say, I was careful about the language there, because I think there is a genuine need for a relationship with the divine, and that religion does correspond with a reality, however distorted or literalized. But if it gets compromised, I mean, if our relationship to our parents is compromised, then our need is driven by something other than just a natural need to be in paradox. And driven more by a need to escape. And so then our negative experiences of our parental figures gets mixed in there and even somewhat projected onto and into a sacred authority complex. And so then we would naturally be prey to and look towards bad parent figures in the priests and shamans who, you know, are exploiting our weakness.
Right, or I'm thinking about, and I refer to myself here, is that as far as I know, I was never abused by my parents or any family figures. Okay. So, using Berman's thesis, because of the part of human nature, you could, David, say this gap, okay, that's in all of us. Okay. Yeah. So I went through that, and that affects me to this day as a middle-aged man. The fact that I was never abused by my parents or any authority figures, sexual, verbal, physically, or otherwise, did not cause a greater rupture that drove me into the arms of shysters.
But we're all in the arms of shysters.
Oh, sure, but I'm keeping this at a general level, because what comes to mind is that definitely somebody who had suffered horrific abuse would be far more likely to be taken advantage of by shysters to a much larger degree.
Well, maybe
or to really go overboard in adopting some kind of a religion, whether they become Catholic or Protestant or Wiccan or whatever it is because they're driven to go to that sense of certainty where, and they're moving away from the parents because of that kind of trauma that happened. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I'm not sure what your point is, but I'll make a counterpoint and see if it's close to your point, which is that neglect is a form of abuse, or at least the effects of neglect are similar to the effects of active abuse. And no one has dodged neglect in our current climate, I think.
No. I think it's worse now than it was in the past, in my opinion.
Hard to say, but yeah, it seems.
Yeah, I would also say that neglect is probably something. I mean, nobody likes to be neglect, but compared to just horrific abuse.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, this is interesting what you're going to say because certain studies, and I've been skeptical about them too, but just to throw it in there. Have indicated that for a child to be completely neglected can die, whereas a child that's physically and even sexually abused is in a certain sense better off than just being completely, you know, having no contact whatsoever.
Now, yeah, of course, I would go with that. Okay. That's where another paradox comes in, is that the very force that is abusing you, you bond to it, is because you have a sense of certainty. Loosely defined, a sense of certainty versus had you been left alone, you know, that you would eventually die because there's no connection there.
Yeah.
That's a worse faith than just being abused.
Well, I mean, who can say in the larger scheme of things, but if you're dead, you're dead, so you don't get to any chance of healing, where somebody who's horrifically abused, and I don't know if I fit in that category or not, because as you know, I'm still trying to explore the depth of my trauma that is unconscious, but they do have the possibility of healing and even coming out the other end better than the average person through that arduous, you know, process. So it's a very, I mean, it's just a huge spectrum here. But I think I'm not actually sure what your point was about. I guess you were just agreeing with me, but you were sort of trying to exempt yourself from it, is what it sounded like.
Well, it's a matter of because my partner, for example, she's involved with sexually abused children.
Yeah.
Not as a psychotherapist, she's a forensic interviewer. So if a child makes a disclosure, she's the one that tries to get to the bottom of it and substantiate type of things. But being around her for so many years and then reading in child sexual abuse myself, I've become a lot more educated on the subject than I once was. And then because it's a little bit more mainstream now where people talk about all kinds of abuse, you know, Strieber, again, would cite as an extreme example of this because of the world he constructed.
Yeah.
Plus listening to you for so many years is that, yeah, this kind of sexual abuse, even if it isn't ritualized, goes a lot deeper than one originally thought and has been going on for quite a long time. And it explains a lot why people, I mean, at least the way I see it, it explains a lot why people are acting the way they do.
Yeah.
They have some kind of unresolved trauma. Who knows what happened to them and if they even remember it. And yeah, I try very hard not to put myself in the position as that, well, I'm glad that I escaped that because, you know, as I say, I'm glad that, or as that, as far as I can remember, I was never abused. But I certainly have gone through the birth trauma where Berman talks about the gap. So I'm not completely whole in that respect. But maybe I'm trying to underscore the fact is that maybe I can see things or that I can sit a lot better with paradox, to use Berman's phrase. Particularly after my philosophical training, where it's not something that is visceral, embodied. It's just something where it's like, well, yeah, it's, you know, if I refer to myself, what is the I? Am I really the I, or am I something else? Type of thing. You know, that maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Well, you're the only one in there, so I guess it's between you and you.
That's right.
Changes in the heart change with the times. Strangers in the night as I've been found.
You have been listening to The Limitless, the podcast between Tim Kay and I. Will continue this exploration of Morris Berman's Wandering God next week. For more about Morris Berman and Wandering God, follow the links in the show notes. 16 Maps of Hell, the unraveling of Hollywood superculture, is not quite on the way to printers, probably a few more weeks. We've raised £11,000 now, so that's covering an extra 50 hardbacks, which are now available again for pre-ordering. I'm going to be working on a Kindle edition also, so that will be available at some point soon. For more about that book, follow the link in the sidebar on any page at horticulture.com, which is also where you can donate or purchase the book if you would like. This is the podcast between the Liminalist. You have now listened.
Change with the night, strangers in the heart, stay up until light. Dangers in your soul, they motion to the stars. Changes in the heart, change with the dark. Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Changes in the heart, change with the times. Yeah. Thank you.